After the ceremony, we celebrated at a restaurant with the Cantwells. Mickey joined us. Her graduation from the public school would not be for another 2 weeks. After the restaurant and all the toasts to our futures, Ernie and I dropped off our parents and grandparents to head to one of several graduation parties. "Are you going with them, Mickey?" my mother asked as she stepped from the car. Mickey begged out, "Not me, Mrs. H. I don't want to be the only girl in a testosterone-fueled room full of Glory Days jocks reminiscing about their high school sports careers. I'll stay here and watch TV with you, if that's okay." When Mickey put it that way, I couldn't blame her. But I also knew that was not her motivation for staying with my mom. My mom had done her very best to put on a happy face. That's not to say she wasn't sincerely happy for me. But with every new beginning, there is an inevitable end we must first accept, and my mother was struggling to accept that her boy had finished high school and would be leaving home in just a few short months. Mickey had begged out of the parties to be with my mom and to cheer her up. In many ways, Mickey had become the daughter my mother never had, and, I suspected, my mother had become the mother Mickey wished she'd had. That night, Ernie and I hit four parties. There was a bit of the Glory Days reminiscing, as Mickey had predicted, but not by Ernie or me. We weren't viewing graduation as an end, as were some of our classmates who had chosen not to go on to college or who had enlisted in the military. Despite my reticence when it came to new adventures and meeting new people, I was looking forward to attending Stanford and living with Ernie. I'd already looked up the school paper, the Stanford Daily, and was hoping I could write for it. I drove Ernie home at just after 1 a.m. When I pulled up to his driveway, he gave me his customary handshake, grabbing my thumb. He pulled me close and put his other hand around the back of my head. "You've been like a brother to me, Sam. I never would have made it this far without you." "You're not going to kiss me, are you?" I said. "I'm serious, man. I've ridden your coattail for 12 years. I hope you don't mind if I ride it for 4 more. You keep getting me sideline passes, and we'll work out some arrangement," I said. Ernie stepped from the Falcon. "Ernie?" I said. He turned back, but when I couldn't find the words, Ernie said them for me. "I know," he said. 17. My mother had left the light on in the kitchen. I shut it off and started up the stairs. But I didn't make it halfway before I heard someone call my name. "Sam?" Mickey stepped from the shadows of the living room, startling me. After catching my breath, I went down the steps to where she stood, her arms wrapped around her body, though it wasn't particularly cold. All kinds of thoughts were flashing through my mind. Her mother or father had died, or something had happened to Joanna. But then I realized that Mickey had not been to her home. She'd been with my mother. "What are you doing here so late?" I could see that she'd been crying, and my concern became fear. "Mickey? What happened?" She shook her head, sobbing. "It's your father, Sam." "What?" She couldn't speak. I looked to the staircase and raced up the stairs 2 at a time. "Dad? Dad!" The rumpled blankets and sheets hung catawampus off the side of my parents' empty bed, and my fear multiplied and nearly overcame me. 18. As Mickey and I entered the waiting room of Our Lady of Mercy Hospital, my mother looked up from a chair. Her eyes were bloodshot and puffy. Tears streaked her cheeks. She held her rosary beads as she always did. I was certain my father had died. "Where is he, Mom?" I asked. I recall this moment as the moment I became a man. It had not been my first beer or hangover, or the first time I'd gotten laid, as I had thought. It had not even been earlier that day when I'd tossed my blue graduation cap into the air. It was the moment my mother needed me, and I was there for her. My mother pointed to a door at the end of the hall that read, "Intensive Care." Then her fingers moved to the next bead, and she continued to pray silently. I asked Mickey to stay at her side and went to the nurse's station. A young woman had her head down but looked up as I approached. I'm Max Hill's son, I said. Can you tell me what happened? The nurse did the all-too-familiar double-take when she saw my eyes. The doctor is with him now. They're running a series of tests. He's alive? Yes, he's alive. What kind of tests? What for? That's what the tests will determine. The doctor will explain everything once we have the test results back. A heart attack? Was it a heart attack? The doctor will talk to you, she said. I'll let him know you're here. When I returned to the waiting room, Mickey was seated with her arm draped around my mother's shoulders. They're running tests, I said. The nurse said it shouldn't be too much longer. I sat on the other side of my mother and watched her fingers manipulate her rosary beads as never before. An hour after we'd arrived, the doctor entered the waiting room wearing blue hospital scrubs and introduced himself as Dr. Thomas Lawrence. How is he? I asked. Dr. Lawrence looked too young to be a doctor. His curly, sandy brown hair showed no signs of gray, but I suspected from his practiced demeanor that he was older than he looked. Your husband is alive, he said to my mother. He suffered a cerebrovascular accident, a stroke. Dr. Lawrence took great care to explain that a blood clot no bigger than a pebble had dislodged itself from inside my father's heart. Riding the pulsing wave of blood, it had traveled swiftly through the arteries in his neck to the right side of his brain before becoming lodged in a branch too narrow for it to pass. The brain tissue beyond the occlusion becomes starved for oxygen, he said. It will begin to die in less than 10 minutes. Meaning what? I asked. Dr. Lawrence grimaced. Practically, it means the right side of your father's face is flaccid, and he is incapable of moving his left extremities. Can't you take the clot out? I asked. Dr. Lawrence shook his head. The MRI shows some blood has already accumulated around the affected area. If we give him thrombolytics, the clot busters, we could cause a massive hemorrhage in the brain and make things worse. What can you do? I asked. Dr. Lawrence shrugged. Watch and wait. Will he get better? My mother asked, her voice a whisper. Dr. Lawrence furrowed his brow. He had intense blue eyes, but now they seemed to soften. It's too early to make predictions, he said, though I can tell he already had. Your husband will be in the hospital about a week. I would recommend we get him to an acute rehab unit as quickly as he is able. We've had some success treating stroke patients by beginning a regimen of intense physical therapy. I'll have the rehab specialist come by in a day or two. Before leaving, Dr. Lawrence turned to me. May I talk to you? Dr. Lawrence and I stepped outside the room. I noticed the slight pause when we made direct eye contact. I didn't want to say anything in front of your mother. I know, I said. How bad is it? The acute rehab unit will give you and your mother some time to consider a long-term care facility. What do you mean long-term? Are you saying he's never going to come home? I could tell from Dr. Lawrence's expression he was trying to be honest without being an alarmist. It will depend on how he progresses, he said. That doesn't need to be determined tonight. I decided not to press him further. When can we see him? You can go in now. He's in the recovery room. We've given him some drugs to sedate him. He'll be in and out, but you can be with him. Can he talk? I asked. Not at the moment, but he'll recognize you, and he'll know you're there. I think it would be a great comfort to him. Your father did manage to ask for you. For me? Are you sure? What's your mother's name? It's Madeline, but he calls her Maddie. Then I'm certain he said Sam. With that, Dr. Lawrence turned and walked away. I watched Dr. Lawrence depart, staring at his back as he went. I turned but did not immediately go back to the waiting room. The realization of what had happened hit me hard at that moment, as manhood often does. I imagined it was not unlike all those young men who join the military, go to boot camp, and then get deployed in a military zone with no one there to wipe their noses or console them. My father had called my name for a reason. He needed me, and not the other way around. He needed me to be the man of the house. I was just 18, but then, so were some of those men taken from the jungles of Vietnam on a stretcher. When I got back to the waiting room, Mickey said she'd go down the hall to call Ernie and the Cantwells, and I sensed she wanted to give my mother and me a moment of privacy with my father. When we entered my father's room, I almost did not recognize the man in the bed. Though he had just a single tube snaking from his right arm, my father looked so much older than he had that morning, his hair seemingly grayer and his face thin, his skin a sickly yellow. The nurse removed the mask covering his mouth and nose, and the side of his face had sagged like wax melted in a hot sun. I hung back as my mother bent and kissed his lips, whispering to him words I could not hear, while gently smoothing his hair. After a minute or two, she motioned me forward, but I could not get my legs to move. My father was my hero, the strongest-willed man I had ever known. Nothing had ever defeated him, not the chain store pharmacies, and not the monthly struggle to make his business succeed. I wondered if that was why he lay here now, in this unforgiving hospital bed, if his unwillingness to ever give in, the incredibly long hours he worked at the store, had led to the stress and anxiety that caused his stroke. My mother took my hand and brought me forward so my father could see me. "Hey, Dad." His face did not move, but his eyes acknowledged me. I touched his arm, which felt cold and soft, and bent and kissed his cheek. For better or for worse, and too often it is for worse for so many of us, adulthood had arrived, whether I wanted it to or not. "I'm here, Dad," I whispered in his ear, "and I'm going to make sure everything is okay. I'm going to take care of things. I'm going to take care of Mom. You just concentrate on getting strong again." 19. The nurses brought in a hospital bed for my mother. "I've slept with that man for 20 years," she said, weeping. "I'm not going to stop now." Mickey and I left the hospital together at close to morning. I passed the turn for our house and continued south on the El Camino. "I'm not going home, Sam," Mickey said. "I'm going to stay at your house." "Okay," I said, without any further comment. "But I have some place I need to go before we go home." I parked on Hillside Drive, directly in front of the OLM church. "Sam?" Mickey said. "You can wait here," I said. Mickey had stopped going to church years earlier. She said she believed in a higher being, but not in religion. I had continued going to Sunday Mass to appease my mother. Any time I suggested I would not go caused friction between us. It had been easier on all of us if I just bit the bullet, though I'd long ago begun to question my faith, or perhaps my mother's faith. After all, I could not recall any occasion when God had stepped in and helped me, despite smashing my prayer bank repeatedly. I figured if there was ever a time for God to show himself, this was it. "I'll go with you," Mickey said. The front doors to the church were locked, but the side door remained open. Inside, the stained glass windows were dark. The overhead fixtures offered only a dull light. Shadows from the flames in the blood-red candles flickered and danced across the walls and the statues of various saints as Mickey and I walked down the center aisle. She took a seat in the first pew. I continued to the railing, genuflected, and made the sign of the cross, but I did not kneel. This was not between me and the man on that cross. I turned to my right, walking to the alcove with the white statue of the barefoot Blessed Mother crushing the snake beneath her feet. I knelt and looked up at her brown porcelain eyes as I had done as a child on that aborted first day of school at OLM. I had the same strange sense I had felt back then, that the Blessed Mother was looking down at me, using the eyes of the statue to see me. I wasn't sure where to begin or what to say, I was angry and upset. If God knows everything, then he knew that much. Why? I finally asked. All she's ever done is pray to you. All she has ever done is ask for your help. Is this what she gets for her devotion? I'm done asking for things for myself. I'm done asking to be normal, for my eyes to change color. But she deserves better. My father deserves better. If this is God's will, then I'm asking you to intervene and for once show me why I am supposed to believe that all of this is for a reason. I want to believe, I said, struggling to hold back tears. I want to believe, okay? But you have to give me some reason to believe. Please. Please give me a reason to believe that everything she's taught me is real and that your son has not abandoned her. Don't do it for me. Do it for her. Heal her husband. Heal my father. Then I thought again of my prayer piggy bank, and in my mind, I smashed it open. This time, I knew, beyond repair. I laid every prayer at the bare feet of the Blessed Mother. I don't know how long I knelt before her. At some point, I felt Mickey's hand on my shoulder. Come on, Sam. Let's go home. On our way out, I stopped before the flickering candles, fishing in my pockets for change. I don't have any money, I said. Mickey grabbed one of the long sticks and lit it, then handed it to me. I don't think God cares about the money at this point, she said. I lit one of the candles, said a silent prayer for my father and my mother, and we left. Mickey drove us home, guiding me upstairs to my room. I felt utterly exhausted, unable to perform even the simplest tasks. My graduation already seemed like months ago. I sat on the bed. Mickey disappeared into the bathroom and emerged wearing one of my t-shirts. What am I going to do? I asked. What are we going to do without him? Mickey untied my shoes and slipped them from my feet. I stood, and she helped unbuckle my belt and the button of my jeans. When I sat, she slipped them from my legs, and I fell back onto the pillow. She slid under the covers beside me, pulling my head to her chest. She'll be lost, I said. Shh, Mickey said, running her fingers through my hair. Go to sleep, Sam. 20. Dr. Lawrence's words would prove prophetic. My father remained in the hospital for 4 days before they moved him to the rehab facility to begin physical therapy. My mother attended every session, getting to the hospital after attending 6 a.m. daily mass. She stayed until late at night, hoping, as I was, that my father would recover enough that she would be able to take him home. As the weeks passed, however, I began to suspect that my prayers would not be answered. Dr. Lawrence confirmed it one day in the hospital. Your mother needs to begin considering a long-term care facility, he said. She wants to take him home and care for him, I said, though I could tell from my father's current condition that would never happen. He shook his head. Your father is going to need constant care, Sam. She couldn't even leave him home alone to go shopping or run an errand. Even if she brought in outside help, the insurance would run out before he dies, I said, the realization dawning. So he isn't going to get better. His condition will improve, but we're talking about minute increments, not leaps and bounds. Never as he was, I said. Never as he was, he agreed. I'd had these conversations, or some semblance of them, at home with Mickey and with Ernie, when my mother was at the hospital. But those had just been esoteric speculation of what might happen, and usually ended with Mickey telling me not to get ahead of myself, to wait until the doctors knew more. Dr. Lawrence's words were not speculation. They were reality. We had closed the pharmacy during my father's illness, But we couldn't keep it closed forever, not if my mother was going to survive. My mother, though, was in no condition to get the store reopened, to run the house, pay the bills, or take care of everything else. It dawned on me that I wouldn't be leaving in the fall to attend Stanford. That couldn't happen. No matter how much my mother tried to convince me, and I knew she would, I could not leave. It was more than just the finances. My father needed me, as did my mother, even if she would never admit it. My acceptance had been nothing but a false hope, yet again. That night, I brought my mother home from the hospital, but I left again, telling her that I had an errand to run. I parked at the curb in front of OLM and climbed those wide, concrete steps. This time, the tall, wooden doors were unlocked. I stepped through them and made my way down the aisle to where the candles burned, where I had lit a candle for my father. I couldn't recall the exact candle, not that it would have mattered, since that candle had certainly burned down. It didn't matter, I told myself. The prayers flickering here were not going to be answered. Licking my thumb and index finger, I reached inside one of the blood-red glass jars and pinched out the flame. 21. The following week, my mother and I drove a winding, two-lane blacktop through the northern Santa Cruz Mountains. Though we were just half an hour from our home in Burlingame, the brown grass, scrub brush, and 200-year-old oak trees that pockmarked the open hills made it feel as though we were far removed from the city. "This one looked nice in the brochure," I said as we neared the care facility. "They all look nice in the brochure." My mother stood in the passenger seat, a red and white scarf tied in a knot beneath her chin to protect her hair from the wind, and sunglasses covering much of her face. She looked the way she had always looked when I had been young and she had been driving the Falcon. But I no longer felt young, and she had not driven the Falcon for 2 years. "That's why they have brochures, to make them look nice." As I had predicted, my mother resisted any talk of my father not coming home. The only way I could even get her to look at the care facilities was to tell her that this need not be permanent, that, in time, if he improved, Dad could come home. He still could not talk, though he was doing better making sounds like words, and he'd recovered some movement on the paralyzed left side of his body. My mother, however, had never failed at anything she'd set her mind to, and she'd set her mind to my father coming home. At this point, I could have said something like, "Maybe it's God's will." But it only would have been hurtful. Besides, I no longer believed in God's will. I was not willing to accept that it was God's will for a good man like my father, a devoted man, to spend his final days in some care facility. After an intervention with Dr. Lawrence and my father's physical therapy team, my mother at least agreed to look at various long-term care options. We had visited 5 of the 6 facilities on the list, but my mother had deemed each too sterile or too clinical, and she thought the staff to be either too robotic or too cavalier. I hadn't liked them, either, for much the same reasons. "If your father has to be sentenced to live out his life in a facility, it will not be a prison sentence," she said after leaving one of the facilities. "That place had all the warmth of a mortuary." At the top of a hill, we came to the Crystal Springs long-term care campus. Upon first sight, I sensed it to be different from the other facilities. The 2-story stucco buildings were connected by covered walkways and painted the same beige color as the dried grass, blending in nicely with the rolling hills. With tiled roofs, arches, and a center fountain, Crystal Springs had the feel of a Spanish mission. "This looks nice," I said, not bothering to add that it should, given that it was the most expensive facility on the list. "You don't judge a book by its cover, Samuel," my mother said. I parked in a space reserved for visitors. The temperature was pleasant, high 70s, with a cool breeze that rustled the leaves of the palm trees and sent ripples of sparkling diamonds across the surface of the Crystal Springs Reservoir in the valley below. We walked a red concrete path to the main entrance. Several patients sat on benches or in wheelchairs, soaking up the sunshine, with staff nearby dressed in maroon shirts. Inside the facility, I asked to speak with Shirley Farley, Crystal Springs' chief administrator. I'd made an appointment earlier in the week, and for some reason, I had expected a mid-50s, heavyset woman in a white nurse's uniform with a stern demeanor, Nurse Ratched from One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. The woman who greeted us wore navy blue slacks and a white blouse and had a smile on her face. She looked and sounded too youthful to be running a care facility. "Mrs. Hill," she said directly to my mother, "I'm glad you could come on such a glorious afternoon. Did you notice the views on the drive?"
"I noticed," my mother said without enthusiasm.
"They're spectacular," I said.
"I wish every day was like this," Farley said. "Unfortunately, we get fog in the fall, and it can be hot in the summer. We try to take advantage of days like this when we can."
"I don't want to be driving that road in the fog," my mother said to me.
"And I hope those poor patients don't get sunburned."
Farley glanced at me, and I smiled. To my mother, she said, "May I show you around the campus?"
"Campus," my mother scoffed.
"Yes, please," I said, though it felt like a waste of time and effort, given my mother's recalcitrant demeanor. Shirley Farley walked us past the fountains and flower beds. "We try to get our clients outside as much as possible," she said. "Fresh air is so important."
"My husband needs constant supervision," my mother said. "I hope you don't leave patients alone."
"Dr. Lawrence mentioned your husband's condition," Farley said. "He would have a member of the staff with him any time he is outdoors." We proceeded to a communal dining hall.
"Some of our clients prefer to eat in their rooms, and we accommodate that," Farley said.
"But we have also found that communal activities, such as dining, have therapeutic effects. We also have movie nights, a book club, chess club, and supervised athletic activities." My mother looked away.
"What type of effects have you noticed?" I asked.
"Our clients exhibit lower rates of depression and increased energy, which promotes their rehabilitation."
"Do any of them ever leave?"
my mother asked.
"Some have," Farley said.
"But I'm going to be honest, Mrs. Hill. Most are here for the duration, which is why we do our best to make it as comfortable as possible. May I show you one of our rooms?" The room Mrs. Farley showed us looked more like an apartment than a hospital room. The walls were a salmon color, the furniture beige and brown. A pony wall partition separated the main room from a small kitchen with a two-burner stovetop, an oven, a refrigerator, and cabinets. The bedroom and bathroom were off the living area.
"This is nice," I said, standing in the kitchen.
"Mom?"
"Your father will not be doing any cooking," my mother said.
"I understood you like to cook, Mrs. Hill," Farley said. I mentioned it to her when we'd spoken on the phone.
"Me?" my mother asked. "Why would that matter? Don't you feed him here?"
Farley smiled. "Of course. But I assumed you would be spending much of your time with your husband, having meals together."
"She could do that?" I asked.
"Many of our clients' spouses eat with them."
That caught my mother's attention.
"Could she spend the night?" I asked.
"I'm afraid not.
But we have extended visiting hours." She looked to my mother, but my mother had moved to a sliding glass door that looked out on a small patio with a view of the mountains and the reservoir. When Farley looked to me, I shrugged.
"Why don't I give you some time to think it over?" she said.
"I'll be in my office if you have any further questions. I've prepared a packet for you to take with you. It's at the front desk." After Farley left, I walked to where my mother stood, and we stared out at the reservoir. No doubt she was wondering the same thing I was wondering. How had we gotten here? How had our lives changed so dramatically in an instant?
"What do you think, Mom?"
I asked rhetorically. We both knew the facility was the best on the list. Neither of us wanted to feel as though we were dumping my father, but it didn't matter how we felt. This was reality, and sometimes reality sucked.
"I think this is the pits," she said. I know, I said. But it's better than the others. And the staff seems friendly. I don't mean the facility, she said. I know, I said. But I didn't want to think of my father living in some facility, and I didn't want to worry about who was taking care of him and how well they were doing so. What was the point? We'd been told that this was our option, and this facility was the best we'd seen. I mean the whole situation, my mother said. It's the pits, isn't it? Yeah, it is, Mom. It really is. Your father worked so hard all his life, and for what? He's going to end up here? It makes you wonder, doesn't it? It truly did. And that was as close as I'd ever come to hearing my mother question her faith. 22. We didn't go home to think it over. My mother and I filled out the paperwork that afternoon in Shirley Farley's office. My mother chose a room with a western view. Your father enjoys the sunsets, she said. My parents' health insurance would cover most, but not all of the costs. I saw no way that my mother could afford the difference. But when I mentioned this, she dismissed it. Money will not dictate your father's comfort, she said. We moved my father the next day, and after my mother and I got him physically situated, I told her I needed to run some errands and would pick up staples for his refrigerator. Ernie and Mickey were waiting for me at the house when I arrived with a small U-Haul trailer. Ernie and I loaded up my father's beloved recliner, side table, and lamp, while Mickey boxed up framed photographs from the mantel. We also rolled up the throw rug in the living room and took a couple of paintings from the walls. I'd cleared this with Mrs. Farley, but had not told my mother. When I knocked on the door to my father's room, my mother opened it to find Ernie and me straining with the weight of the recliner. What are you doing? She asked. If Dad can't come home, we're going to bring home to Dad. Ernie and I set down the throw rug and recliner along with the side table and lamp. After my mother composed herself, she and Mickey arranged the photographs around the room, hung the paintings, and put away the kitchenware, pots and pans, and cutlery. By the time Mickey was finished, the refrigerator and shelves were stocked. It wasn't home, but it was the next best thing. There's only one thing missing, I said. My mother looked at me inquisitively. I think tonight would be a good night for your lasagna, I said, and I pulled out one my mother had frozen. Despite my mother's insistence, Mickey and Ernie did not join us for dinner, wanting to give us time alone. The three of us sat together at the table, my father listening in his wheelchair. My mother reached out and took his hand, and we created our traditional circle. Dear Lord, she said, though we do not know your ways, we accept that everything that happens is your will. Help us to accept that which we cannot change. Give us the courage to change what we can, and the wisdom to know the difference. I humored her and said, Amen. My mother served me a wedge of lasagna and said, We shared our first moments together, the three of us, in a hospital. And she told me again about the day I was born. I listened and asked the same questions, sensing that telling the story was cathartic for her. After dinner, we helped my father into his recliner, and my mother read the newspaper to him. Then we turned on the television for him, and my mother sat on the couch to say her rosary. Her continued devotion in the face of all that had happened amazed me, but at this point, I had concluded that I no longer shared her faith in a God who controlled the universe like a puppet master, pulling and tugging strings and making us all dance. Our lives, I believed, were more like billiard balls on a pool table, ricocheting randomly with the impact of the cue ball. To believe otherwise was to believe that a God to whom my mother had devoted her life had responded by striking down her husband and causing her so much pain. I couldn't accept that. Shortly after 9, there was a knock on the door. 2 hospital staff members entered to assist in putting my father to bed. It was time to leave, and I had dreaded this moment more than any other. My mother leaned over my father's bed, her cheek pressed to his, her hands rubbing his face and combing his hair. It would be the first time since they were married they would not sleep in the same bed. She clung to him, tears flowing. Though the stroke had left my father's face an expressionless mask, I watched his eyes pool until a lone tear rolled down his cheek. It was unbearable, and became even more so when I had to step in and separate them. 23. The next week, I held a meeting in the back room of the pharmacy with my father's longtime pharmacy technician, Betty, as well as a young girl my father had hired to work the front counter. They were understandably concerned not only about my father, but for their jobs. It had been nearly 3 weeks since his stroke. "The store will remain open," I assured them. "How?" they asked in near unison. "We're going to hire a pharmacist," I said. "All of us. The first one will be coming for an interview this afternoon." I hoped that including them in decisions concerning the store's future would ease their concerns and make them feel invested. "There was a man here from Long's," Betty said, meaning the chain drugstore. "He wants to buy your father's files. He said he'd make a fair offer, and he'd hire all of us." "I can't stop you from taking the job," I said, "but I'm not selling my father's files to a chain drugstore. I can't do that. Give me a month. That's all I'm asking." Betty looked skeptical, but agreed. "Your father worked too hard for us to give up. But, Sam, do you know what you're in for?" Maybe I was being naive. Maybe I didn't know what I was in for. But I also knew there was only one way to find out. "With your help, I can do it," I said. "Just give me the chance." We interviewed 4 pharmacists in 2 days and met again in the back of the store. "I like Frank," Barb said, making our choice unanimous. "He most resembles your father's personality, and that will help keep our customers from defecting." "I have a plan for that also," I said. I handed Barb and Betty the flyer Mickey and I had created, an invitation to a Saturday reception to Meet Your Neighborhood Pharmacist. "We're going to slip them under the windshields of every car parked on Broadway and mail them to every customer. Then we'll follow up with a personal phone call." My mother was not involved in any of this. She arrived at the Crystal Springs campus at 7 each morning, often bringing the staff donuts or bagels and fresh fruit, though our finances were tight. She spoon-fed my father his breakfast and helped him get dressed, then spent the day participating in his rehab. At night, she kept to their routine, reading him the newspaper and saying her rosary while my father watched television until visiting hours were over. I went to bed that Friday night and dreamed that I threw a party, and no one came except David Bateman. 24. We scheduled the reception at the pharmacy to begin Saturday at 10 a.m. Mickey, Ernie, and I arrived at 9 to set up a few tables, which looked pathetically bare, until Mr. and Mrs. Cantwell backed up their Mercedes and started unloading trays of finger sandwiches, vegetables and dip, cheese and crackers, homemade cookies and brownies, and bottles of wine and cans of soft drinks. I didn't know what to say. "You want a crowd? Serve them food," Mrs. Cantwell said. Mickey tied helium-filled balloons to the parking meters in front of the store and to the ends of the aisles inside, giving the store a festive look. There was nothing left to do but wait. I paced the floor like an expectant father. "What if nobody comes?" I said to Mickey. I knew Barb and Betty were pleased with Frank, but if we didn't have customers, we didn't have a store. "They'll come," Mickey said. "Have faith." "Oh, God, don't say that. You sound like my mother." "Not faith in God," she said. Mickey professed to be agnostic. "Faith in your father. His customers loved him." And it showed. When we opened the door at 10, his most loyal customers were waiting. Some brought food to supplement our spread and for me to take home from my mother's freezer. Every one of them shook my hand and told me how sorry they were to hear about my father. Most important, they told me they weren't moving their files. They were staying put. Betty and Barb poured mimosas, and Mickey and Ernie circulated the hors d'oeuvres while Frank and I greeted each guest. Frank was better than I'd expected, personable and professional. In between filling prescriptions and answering questions, he worked the crowd like a politician stumping for votes. I don't know if it was a testament to my father or our efforts, but just about every client on my father's Rolodex came that day. Afterward, as Mickey, Ernie, and I cleaned up, Mickey said, "You did it, Hill. You saved your father's store." But I knew better. This was just the first step. The most important day is Monday. "What happens Monday?" Ernie asked. "Monday, I go to work." "What are you talking about?" Ernie said. "My mother can't afford the care facility, but she also won't admit it. The insurance doesn't cover all the expenses, and their savings won't last more than a year. I hired myself to run the store. Betty said she'd train me to order merchandise and pay vendor bills." "What about Stanford?" "I'm going to defer for a year, until my mother gets back on her feet." Ernie turned away, upset. "She'll never go for that. Not in a million years," Mickey said. "She won't know," I said. "How will she not know? Hello? You live in the same house." But we didn't. Not anymore. My mother stayed with my father until closing, and, as a result, rarely arrived home until well after 9. By that time, she was too tired to do anything except kiss me atop the head and go upstairs to bed. 25. Every morning that summer, I awoke at 6 and went to the store to ready it to open. I stayed until it closed, ran the deliveries, then went to visit my father for an hour before covering whatever sporting event I could pick up from the Times to make extra cash. As the fall approached, I began to see Ernie and Mickey less and less as they prepared to leave for college. The night before their departures, I planned what I sacrilegiously referred to as our last supper. I cooked a meal fit for 3 kings: barbecued steaks, mashed potatoes, green peas, and a squash soup. I even baked and frosted a cake, decorating it with candles and frosting and writing, "Good luck, Mickey and Ernie." "You keep this up, and I might marry you," Ernie said as I put the spread on the table. "Get in line," Mickey said. As the 3 of us dug in, Ernie asked, "Have you told her yet?" "No." "You're gonna have to soon." "Maybe not," I said. "I hardly ever see her anymore, and when we're home, I might as well be invisible. Maybe she won't figure out that I never left." "She'll figure it out," Mickey said, "and she isn't going to be happy about it." "She has no choice in the matter," I said. "She can't get by without me. She can't do it all by herself." "Neither can you," Mickey said. "You're exhausted, Sam." "It won't be forever." "No? How long will it be for?" Mickey asked. "I told you, just until I get the store settled and running smoothly." Ernie laughed. "What's so funny?" I asked. "You," he said. "I talked to Betty today. She raved about what you've done. She says the store never ran this smoothly." I knew from the numbers that income was up 15%, and Frank was filling more than 100 prescriptions a day. We were so busy, we were discussing bringing in a second pharmacist on our busiest days, and I was making an annual salary that would help make ends meet for my mother and pay all 4 years' tuition at Stanford. "You have a knack for business," Ernie said. I'm meeting with a tax attorney in the morning to create a corporation. Frank wants to buy into it after his 6-month probationary period ends, I said. Mickey dropped her fork. "Probationary period? Holy shit, Hill! You've become a hard ass." I had to be certain he was the right fit, I said. "If it works out, his monthly payment will bring in extra money every month, which will help my mother get by when I'm no longer pulling a salary. I'm going to suggest that she take over my position, but I'm not sure she'll do it if it takes her away from my father." Ernie wolfed down a slice of cake and pushed back from his chair. "I have to go see Alicia," he said. "Jesus, can't you give it a rest for one night?" Mickey said. "I wish. She calls me all the time now. She's afraid I'm going to find someone else and forget about her." "You will," Mickey said. Thanks, Mick. Ernie stood and slipped on his coat. Maybe I should have you talk to her for me and provide that comforting reassurance.
After Ernie left, we cleared the dishes. Mickey said, they won't last 3 months.
Probably not, but did you have to say it?
He said it before I said it.
He didn't say that. He didn't have to say it. It was in his tone and body language. He doesn't love her.
How do you know? I asked.
Because I practically grew up here, and I saw what your mother and father have, she said. What they have, that's love.
I didn't disagree, and their kind of love seemed more and more rare. I wiped down the table with a rag. They deserved a lot better than what they got.
Yeah, well, life isn't fair, Sam.
I threw the rag in the sink.
Thanks. That really cheered me up. Why don't you just tell me it's God's will, like my mother?
Because I'm not your mother.
No kidding. My mother's a lot more compassionate than you.
What are you looking for? Sympathy?
Would it be too much to ask?
I'm sure not getting any answers from him, I said, pointing at the ceiling. I was tired of Mickey discounting everyone's feelings. I knew she had it tough at home, and she seemed to be dealing with it by hardening her heart. Maybe for once he could show me that he really does have some plan for me, because I'm damn tired of trying to figure it out on my own. My father's in a goddamn rehabilitation center, where everyone gets excited when he can mumble an understandable word, and my mother doesn't even know I exist anymore. You went from being a kid whose parents did everything for him to being an adult. Welcome to the real world, Sam. Life is the shits, but the alternative is worse. Get over it.
Why do you always do that? I said, exasperated.
Do what?
Minimize everything. Make it like it's no big deal. Say things like what you said about Alicia.
Because this is the real world, and life isn't for pussies.
Yeah, well, I'm tired of it. And what do you know about the real world?
A lot more than you. I've been on my own since I was 14.
What are you talking about? I don't remember you running a business, cleaning the toilets, paying the bills, shopping.
That's because you weren't there, she fired back.
And I didn't complain about it. My mother was sauced so often she couldn't get off the couch.
Who do you think did all those things? The fairies? My lazy, good-for-nothing older brothers?
I've been doing the laundry since I was 12, shopping and making the school lunches while my mother slept off her hangovers. When I got my driver's license, Joanna cried because we wouldn't have to get in the car with my mother drunk anymore. Then my father moves out, gets himself a bimbo, and thinks he's a father because he sees us two nights a week. Or did you forget all of that? Don't give me your sob story. You talk about your mother not knowing you're alive for a couple of months? Big deal, Hill. My mother has never known I was alive.
We stared each other down, silently brooding, unwilling to concede. I had my arms crossed over my chest and my back against the kitchen counter. The urge came over me, and I couldn't resist. I picked up one of the peas from a plate on the counter and flicked it at Mickey. Under normal circumstances, I would have missed by a wide margin. But these were not normal circumstances, and I did not miss. In a game of darts, I threw a bullseye. The pea hit Mickey between the eyes, and because I had overcooked them, stuck for an instant before falling. Her jaw dropped.
Did you just really hit me in the face with a pea?
Yeah, well, life isn't fair, Michaela. She squinted.
What have I told you about calling me Michaela?
I don't remember.
Michaela?
Mickey sprang like a cat. She had her hand in the pea bowl, and the next thing I knew, pea juice dribbled down my face. The war had begun. The peas flew. After we emptied the bowl, we found those squished on the counter and cabinets and continued flinging and mashing. I spun, felt my foot slip, and reached out and grabbed the first thing my hand touched, Mickey's pea-stained blouse. It nearly tore off as I pulled her to the ground on top of me.
The rip revealed a black lace bra. I started to laugh, and after a moment, she did too. We continued until my stomach began to hurt.
Okay, get up, I said as our laughter subsided.
But Mickey did not roll off. She looked down at me as if she were seeing a thousand different things in my red eyes. Then she said, "Screw it," and pressed her lips to mine. Unlike the night of my prom, Mickey did not pull back, and she did not stop at the first kiss. A part of me screamed to apply the brakes, knowing that what was about to transpire could not be a good thing, that it could ruin the best friendship I'd ever had. But that part of me quickly lost the battle to the part that longed to feel loved again and to act on the deep, burning desire I'd always had to touch Mickey. I also knew that debate raged only in my mind. Mickey wasn't about to stop. Discretion and self-control were not hallmarks of her personality. She smothered me with kisses, her hands rubbing my hair and finding their way beneath my shirt to the buckle of my belt. I emptied my head of all doubt and allowed my body the freedom to become lost in the warmth and beauty of Michaela Kennedy. 26. Afterward, I wanted nothing more than to lie on the floor, covered in peas, and to hold Mickey close while we let the world of vendor invoices, dirty laundry, and drunk parents pass us by. I realized that I had wanted this, despite my own misgivings, for years. I loved Mickey, and not just as a friend. I saw in her the chance to have what my parents shared, what we both knew my parents shared. Love. Real love. But my fear, the one that had first entered my thoughts before my desire for Mickey shoved it aside, wiped away those thoughts and dreams the way my father's stroke had wiped away our bucolic existence. Mickey got up quickly and gathered her clothes, slipping them on. "Don't you want to take a shower?" I said. "I have to go." I got to my feet. "No, you don't. You don't have to leave. I have to pack." We were going to watch a movie. But Mickey had already gathered her shoes and purse and pulled out her car keys. Her blouse hung open, beyond repair. "Your shirt, let me..." She kissed me, not the passionate embrace we had just shared, but a peck on the cheek. "See you, Hill," she said. And just like that, Mickey the Tornado was gone. 27. I stood listening to the sound of the car engine grow faint as Mickey drove off, and I was soon lost in thought and regret. I should have stopped it. I should have told Mickey it was a bad idea. But damn it, I didn't want to. I knew that our friendship was complicated. No, we were not dating. But yes, we did spend a lot of time together hanging out, going to dinner, and watching movies. No, we'd never slept together until that moment. But yes, I'd thought about what that would be like, and maybe, just maybe, we could be more than best friends. Maybe we could be boyfriend and girlfriend. I was lost in that debate when I heard the garage door opening. For a moment, I thought Mickey had come back. Then I wondered why Mickey would be opening the garage door. She wouldn't be. She didn't have a remote. I looked up at the clock. My mother had come home early. I barely had time to gather my clothes and rush upstairs into the bathroom before I heard the door leading from the garage into the kitchen close with a thud. I could only imagine my mother's chagrin at the sight of her normally immaculate kitchen covered in peas. I turned on the shower, half expecting her to open the bathroom door and yell something like, "What in tarnation happened around here?" But the door did not open. I scrubbed quickly, but I had peas everywhere. Finally clean, I changed into sweatpants and a t-shirt. My mother was not in her room getting ready for bed. When I walked downstairs, I was prepared to act surprised that she was home, then take over the chore of cleaning up. But I also did not find her cleaning the kitchen. "Mom?" "In here." She sat in the dark, in her customary spot on the living room sofa. I thought she might be saying her novena, but she did not have her rosary beads in hand. Why are you sitting in the dark? I was with your father. Her gaze remained unfocused. I was feeding him, and I was thinking about all the things I had to do for him, now that he is incapable. I sat on the ottoman facing her. She was talking to herself as much as to me. She raised her eyes to mine. And that's when it dawned on me. What? I asked. That I hadn't done the wash, or the shopping, or cleaned a plate, or cooked a meal. I haven't done any of those things. You've been doing it all, haven't you, Sam? It isn't a big deal, Mom. And the store? Who's been running the store? I hired a pharmacist. His name is Frank. You hired... You'll like him, Mom. He's a lot like Dad. But what about the ordering, paying the bills, stocking the shelves, deliveries? I didn't answer. She sighed. Oh, Sam. I'm so sorry. You have nothing to be sorry about. This was supposed to be your summer, your graduation. You've missed it all, haven't you? Nothing to miss, really. Ernie said most of the parties were lame. He and Mickey spent most nights here with me. Mickey, she said, she needs you, Sam. I was no longer so certain. I learned how to cook and do the laundry, so that's a good thing, right? She closed her eyes and took maybe the first deep breath she had taken since my father's stroke. Then she said, we're going to get back on track now, Sam, now that you're leaving for college. I looked away. Sam? I'm not going, Mom. She put up a hand. Yes, you are. Not this year. Sam, I realize you felt the need to take care of everything for your father and me, but I can handle this now. Your father has good care, and that will give me some time during the day. I already asked for a year deferral from the admissions office. Well, unask. I shook my head. It's done. They've reallocated my financial aid and assigned Ernie a new roommate. She pressed the palms of her hands against her eyes, sobbing. I knelt at the foot of her chair and touched her forearms. Mom, it's okay. This was my decision, and I'm fine with it. I'll take the year to learn to run the business. It will be the best education I could ever receive. And the money I earn, along with my scholarships and the financial aid package, will pay for my tuition. When you have Dad set, you can take over for me. You'll need the income, and it will keep you busy during the day. She lowered her hands and gripped mine. Promise me, Sam. Promise me next fall you'll go, no matter what. I promise, I said. Absolutely. She took another deep breath and exhaled. After a bit, I said, I better go clean up the peas. No. You've done enough. She stood. I saw a movie on the table. Mickey and I were going to watch it, but she had to go home. If you wouldn't mind the company, I could use a distraction. I'll clean up the peas and make popcorn, I said. Forget the damn peas, my mother said. 28. The next morning, I awoke early, but my mother had already cleaned up the mess in the kitchen and left to be with my father. I picked up flowers and drove the El Camino. I would tell Mickey that I hoped she didn't regret what we had done, because I didn't. I would tell her that it wasn't going to ruin our friendship, because I wanted to be more than friends. I loved Mickey. I knew it then, and I was convinced it could be the same kind of love my mother and father shared. What was better, after all, than being in love with your best friend? Walking up the driveway, I felt butterflies and had to tell myself this was the same person with whom, 12 hours earlier, I would have shared my darkest secrets. Joanna answered, looking up at me with her big brown eyes from beneath wisps of bangs and smiling brightly. Hi, Sam. Hi, Jojo, She leaned back, swinging on the door handle, smiling. Is Mickey here?